This is the Dr. Robert Brennan Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Yes, this is TNT, and filling in for the gigantic shoes of Mike Ryan is Robert Brennan today. And so just before I introduce our guests of the hour, just another little update from, well, would you call it the regular news? No doubt you're all aware that the southern states of the United States receive literally thousands of legal immigrants by the day. Texas alone receives about several thousand per day. Now, the northern states, which are arguably largely populated by those who are less sympathetic with the problems of the border of the southern states. Well, New York, for example, is groaning under the pressure with 7,600 immigrants in homeless shelters. Meanwhile, they're having struggles to house the locals who have either fallen on tough times regarding their homelessness and or the chronic homeless of New York. And so we're going to get in this next half hour to, well, housing and mortgage stress and that. So sort of it tangentially touches upon the point of the first interview. Meanwhile, we have Greg Abbott, the Texas governor. He sends two buses of migrants to Washington, D.C. and dumps them outside the residence of Vice President Kamala Harris. And Ron DeSantis, the Florida governor, charters a couple of jets to fly 50 Venezuelan, I think that they're Venezuelan migrants, to the very wealthy enclave in Massachusetts known as Martha's Vineyard. They spend 2 days in the vineyard. There's some photo ops with I guess what you could charitably call, you know, the virtue signaling elites of the area before they signal the National Guard to come and collect them and to relocate them to a military base at Cape Cod where they remain to this day. So no doubt this is a stunt of DeSantis and one that was quite expensive in chartering the jets. But he's also making a statement and calling out the hypocrisy of those who would say, well, we must accept the migrants, we must manage them, we must house them, da-da-da-da-da, but it won't be me and it won't be my state or it won't be my suburb or it won't be my little group. So, okay, on that note, I'm going to introduce our first guest of the hour, and Martin North is our first guest. Martin is the principal of Digital Finance Analytics, and you can check that out as a website, all one word, digitalfinanceanalytics.com, which provides primary consumer research, industry modeling, economic analysis, and segmentation analytics to offer insights into the dynamics of mortgage, lending, savings, payments, and superannuation industries. Digital Finance Analytics makes daily YouTube shows on property and finance at, quote, Walk the World, and analyzes housing and mortgage finance for the DFA channel, blog, and mainstream media. He's also the other half of a group including economist John Adams, and they host another YouTube channel called In the Interests of the People. Good afternoon, Martin.
G'day.
It's indeed an honour. and might I just, to start off with, just getting In the Interests of the People part of your introduction out of the way. You and John Adams deal with very serious issues. I don't mean to make light of them, but when I see you two together, I think of the idea and comedy of the straight man, and you appear to be the straight man of the couple, that is yourself and John Adams. And Jerry Lewis once spoke of Dean Martin to say that the toughest job is the job actually of the straight man. So how do you two get along? And the fact that you actually serve a very interesting function, because I've watched your videos, you're like the credibility filter, so that when John Adams says things that are a little bit kind of controversial, it's passed through you as, well, if you accept it and you're listening and you take it seriously, so should the consumer. So that's quite a responsibility you've got there.
Well, yeah, it's an interesting relationship. We've been doing it 4 years now on the interest of the people, and it's worth saying that the title was carefully chosen in the interest of the people, and it was based on a view that both John and I have, that a lot of what is going on in politics and economics is not in the interest of the people. Mm-hmm. And yet, partly through the mainstream media, partly because of the way politics works, quite often people, I think, are deceived and misdirected. So they think everything's fine when it's not. So what we've tried to do is to deal with some of those really thorny issues. For example, we fought the cash ban, $10,000 cash ban, transaction ban that was actually around a few years ago. And we're at the moment having a significant discussion about the role of investor protection in Australia, because ASIC is the main entity that essentially should be looking after our interests, but actually our view is that they're not really up to the job. And what tends to happen is that John does a lot of deep research on these issues, and then he and I sort of discuss this on the channel. And as you say, I'm a bit of a sort of a credibility filter, I guess, and also trying to sort of wrap around my own experience of financial services and how it works so that we can ground it in reality for people. But there are really important issues here that we're touching on that really do impact pretty much everybody, whether you've got a mortgage or whether you've got savings or a superannuation. And unfortunately, in the mainstream, a lot of these things aren't being talked about.
Yes. Might I say, though, I won't ask you to reveal the so-called package, but you guys can certainly, you can cook the suspense, but try not to overcook it too much.
Well, yeah, we made a show a couple of days ago because we've basically gone as far as we can go with the specifics of what John's been involved in. But what we were trying to highlight is the hurdle that anybody has to face to try and get ASIC to take a complaint seriously, right? I mean, John wrote 608 pages of stuff and managed to get ASIC to look at a particular issue that he'd identified. But most people don't stand a chance. 0.78% of all submissions to ASIC for them to look at things get moved forward, right? 0.78%. That's horrendously low. So, as a normal investor, and quite a few investors do get taken to the cleaners, for all sorts of reasons. If normal investors think that ASIC look after their back, no, they don't. They don't. They are actually, I think, more on the side of the big financial services organizations than they are on the individual investor or consumer. So, we can't go into more detail about the package at this stage because it's now actually being investigated. But it's the principle that we're trying to highlight here. Most investors expect a level of protection from ASIC. In reality, it's not there.
Well, well warned. So far as your work, Walk the World implies that we're having a consideration not just of Australian finance, but of the world. And so we've got economic sanctions on Russia. We've got energy security issues, and particularly in Europe. And then we've got the issues with China and, a hot-headed talk between not so much this current U.S. administration, but the previous one, but also this one, as I spoke about Biden earlier. So with all of those things going on, do you see them having, where do you see their impact on the world economy in the coming months and how that might impact Australia? Going from the big picture on down to the more granular.
Yeah. So I think the thing to understand is that our economy here in Australia is predominantly being influenced and impacted by all of those global forces. And I guess many people would think that, the Reserve Bank here could make independent views as to what they should be doing, et cetera, or even the politicians. But no, actually, people need to understand that there is effectively a set of international dynamics, whether you recognize them or not, that actually are shaping a lot of things that are going on at the moment. We had a whole wave of globalization over the last 20 to 30 years and international trade agreements and all those things, which took away power from individual countries and sort of shifted the goalposts towards benefiting large corporates, international companies and those sorts of things. Now, what's happened in the last 2 or 3 years in particular, and we had COVID, of course, and then we've had other issues later, is that some of the cracks are really appearing now. And if you look at China, for example, you know, we know that the economy there is under a lot of pressure at the moment. The property sector in China is pretty weak. And as a result of that, China, who is our number one trade partner, is looking extremely weak, and potentially we may be shipping less stuff to China than we've been used to. Now, that's going to have a big impact on our trade balance and therefore the earnings that we generate back in Australia. And of course, we had this sort of $50 billion spurious profit that was reported recently, thanks to the high prices of gas and those sorts of things. But that may not continue. And if it doesn't, that then has a significant economic impact here in Australia. Or again, if you take the gas price, you know, the gas, international gas prices, well, it's gone all over the place, but it's still much higher than it was, about seven times higher than it was. Now, it's worth saying our domestic gas prices are directly impacted by those international gas prices, partly because of the structure that we've got in Australia, particularly down the East Coast, without any what's called a gas reservation. So we're directly exposed. So that means that our costs of living, particularly the price of electricity, because of course, electricity prices are marginally priced off the cost of gas, are very much higher, and they will be a lot higher. But internationally, of course, that's also true. That's putting a huge downdraft across Europe, because the conflict in Ukraine has also turned off gas supplies from Russia to Europe. So Russia indirectly is squeezing Europe from an energy perspective, and that's putting a huge upward pressure on those prices, and that is lifting inflation. So we know we've got that issue going on. And then the other issue we've got, of course, internationally, is we've got massive rampant inflation. Now, a lot of things can be said about that, but I think three important things. The first is this was created by stupid central bank policy over the last decade, where they've basically taken interest rates to an ultra low level. They've done a lot of quantitative easing, that was flooding the economies with lots of money. And guess what? When you throw a lot of dollars to chase the same goods and services, the price goes up. So that's the core root of why inflation is now very high. Now, of course, the conflict in Ukraine and high gas prices and other things and the supply chain disruptions through COVID had contributed to it too. But we've got the situation now where around the world we're struggling with very high inflation. In fact, collectively, you know, about 90 central banks have raised interest rates this year, and half of them have increased them by at least 75 basis points, 0.75%, in one shot. That includes the Swiss National Bank earlier on Thursday this week. On Wednesday, the Federal Reserve announced a third consecutive 0.75% increase, and Sweden, they moved a full 1 point. We're in a high and moving up interest rate environment. Now, that is going to have profound impacts for us here in Australia, not least because of our highly leveraged mortgage market. And a lot of people, I think, are already feeling the pain, but also it's going to have a huge impact in terms of economic slowdown. So pretty much all of the major international entities like the World Bank and the IMF, World Economic Forum, are all saying, looks like a recession's coming, and that's going to have a significant downward pressure. So what I'm trying to sort of illustrate is, when you look at our local economy, you've got to take account of the, you know, international dynamics around interest rates and price of gas, all those things. We are, I think, facing into a gale, and I'm not sure that many people in Australia get just what's coming down the pipes.
Yes, and like it's often said, that when the US catches a, what is it, sneezes, we catch a cold, and and elsewhere in the Northern Hemisphere besides. And so, yeah, you're talking about the rising interest rates, which of course influences, it increases the costs of mortgage repayments. But on the other hand, if you have low rates, then that, well, it increases an interest within the real estate market that drives up prices. And so that increases the cost of repayment. So either way, it seems like you're between the devil and the deep blue sea if you want to get into the housing market.
Well, you've made a really, really important point, right? People don't understand this. The most significant lever to what house prices does is interest rates. Mm-hmm. If you cut interest rates, property prices shoot through the roof because you can borrow more for the same amount of repayments. If interest rates rise, then the amount you can borrow goes down, and that means you can borrow less. And the typical, what I call mortgage borrowing power now, is down about 20 to 30% from where it was 6 months ago. So if you go to the bank today on the same income and profile, they'll offer you a 30% smaller loan than previously. So that is why, and it's worth just reflecting on what's happened already. If you look at property prices in Australia, since recent peaks in prices, and of course everything shot up through those ultra low interest rates through COVID, Sydney prices are down 8.7%, Melbourne prices from their peak down 5.4%, Brisbane down 4.2%, Adelaide is now down just a little, 0.4%, and Perth is down 0.5%. So all of the major markets are now actually seeing a reversal because interest rates are rising. And of course, the RBA is now sitting on an interest rate of 2.35%, which is still quite low. And we've got to expect more interest rate rises. But it's also worth making the point that it takes about 3 months or so between an interest rate announcement from the RBA to filter through to higher mortgage repayments for households. So that means that we haven't yet seen the full impact of all the rate rises that have already been announced, which means that you've got to expect that home prices are going to continue to slide and I think accelerate more quickly. And in fact, the most recent data from CoreLogic, for example, this week has shown that all of those major markets have dropped this week. So we are, I think, now in a down cycle and a significant down cycle. But you made the earlier point, you know, when rates come down, you can afford perhaps to buy a bigger property. When rates go up, you can't. And that's the point. Affordability is not improving because of the fact that borrowing power has been reduced. So in fact, it's harder than ever for first-time buyers to get into the market at the moment. So we've got a housing market that has been dysfunctional for at least two or three decades. None of the major political parties, nor indeed the states, want to tackle the root cause issues. And of course, the RBA and APRA, who are those main guiding institutions, claim no responsibility for house prices. And yet, as I say, the most significant lever of house prices is interest rates.
Mm. And that's the other APRA, not the one I dealt with, which is the Australian Health Practitioners Regulator. That's the other APRA. So on that note, we're going to take a quick ad break. This is TNT.
You should hear what Jesse Zerowell is talking about.
In addition to calling up 300,000 reservists, which does not include conscripts or university students, Putin has made some what could be described as inflammatory statements, if I can use that cliche, regarding the possible use of nuclear weapons.
In Russian language media, I mean, especially among hardliners, like people who really support the special operation, they're saying this is really, really bad because, first of all, territorial gains aside, what basically has happened is that Russia took control of territory, and then those Ukrainians who wanted to cooperate with Russia and consider themselves Russian, if the idea here was that Russia was going to go into Ukraine to protect ethnic Russians, to guarantee that, you know, Ukrainians can speak Russian and live in harmony and peace with Russia, the problem is that all these territories that Russia goes into, they're not guaranteed that they're staying, you know? And sometimes, in some cases, they say like, oh yeah, we're here forever. And then, you know, a month later, they leave. How can you do this? It's so self-defeating, and it makes cooperation or welcoming the Russian military as liberators impossible. It's like a death sentence.
Jesse Zerowell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Did you know that hepatitis C causes tens of thousands of U.S. deaths every year? Hepatitis C is the leading cause of cirrhosis and liver cancer, and the leading cause of death from liver disease. Those who have hepatitis C often don't even know it. But there is good news. Not only good, but easy. A simple blood test will tell you whether or not you have hepatitis C. If you do have it, it's curable. More than 9 out of 10 people who receive highly effective treatment are cured and less likely to develop liver cancer or liver complications. In fact, one little blood test and you can do your part to help eliminate hepatitis C for good. Get tested, get treated, get cured. Visit hep.org for more information.
We were told that the last presidential election was the most secure election in history. Nope, not by a long shot. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
This is Robert Brennan, my very special guest, finance expert and analyst Martin North. I must ask you, Martin, I mean, I predicted pretty well everything in terms of what happened with the COVID response, but one thing I got completely wrong. I thought that the consumers would become very cautious, but instead in 2020, I noticed, because I live on the Gold Coast, they were just mortgaging themselves to the hilt. They were renovating themselves to the hilt as much as they could borrow. It was extraordinary. That seemed what was happening. And so do you think that that was something in the psychology of the consumer, or did the system, so to speak, egg them on?
Well, I think the system egged them on. If you think about what happened, people were able to draw money out of superannuation, quite a lot of money, actually, and a lot of people did that. We had, of course, the support mechanisms from the government, and that were huge payouts through to both individuals and businesses. So there was a lot of cash sloshing around. Now, at the beginning of COVID, of course, nobody quite knew what was going to happen, and they forecast a significant recession, if not depression, and very high unemployment. And so they pulled all the stops out. However, I must tell you that I think they overreacted and then didn't course correct early enough, because it was quite clear earlier on, as house prices started shooting through the roof, that things were actually way too stimulated. And when interest rates came down to 0.1%, that was just crazy, because you could get a mortgage at under 2%. Mm. Those are prices that are just ridiculous. So going back to what I said, when you actually reduce interest rates, property prices go up. That's why we got a 20 to 30% rise. But it created, of course, huge imbalances. Plus, of course, we had a lot of people, for example, people down in Melbourne looking at Queensland and saying, gee, property's cheap up there and the weather's better. Maybe I should buy there. So they started buying sight unseen of properties in all sorts of places across Queensland. One mm-hmm. reason why Queensland prices went up significantly. So it was a great example, I think, of complete overreaction from the authorities and not understanding the consequences of their actions. And I heard politicians through 20 and 21 saying, great time to buy, first time buyers, go and buy a property. But people were dragged into that. They were committed to prices that were way too high when interest rates were very low, which meant they had no wriggle room. And whilst, of course, in theory, banks had a 2.5%, then a 3% buffer to think about how repayments would work, in many cases, those buffers are artificially low relative to what real life experience is. Now inflation's running really fast. So many people are now caught with interest rates rising, which is why we're seeing property prices fall. But no, it was a complete overreaction. Mm. And it was a system-wide issue. And unfortunately, both the politicians and the regulators got it completely wrong.
Yes. And so do you think that they're serious about tackling this problem, and given that it's nested in higher cost of living with inflation, with tackling that too, the US Fed and the Australia's RBA? Or are they just sort of playing politics and wanting to placate?
Look, there isn't... most economists will tell you that inflation, if it gets a hold on the economy, can really wring people dry, particularly those whose incomes don't grow very quickly, the lower echelons of society. They're the ones hit the most. The question you've got to ask yourself is, if they're serious about tackling the inflation that we've got, then the logic says you have to actually put interest rates at a level that matches the rate of inflation to snuff it out. None of the central banks have so far done that. And in fact, it was only recently that central banks were saying, well, it's transitory, it's going to go away on its own. Well, it's clearly not. So they're now lifting rates significantly. And, the Federal Reserve, I said, 0.75%, RBA, 50 basis points a couple of weeks ago. They'll probably do more in October. That they are trying to now get their grip on inflation. But, of course, the question is, will it come down? A couple of reasons why it might not. The first is that a lot of the inflation was created by the quantitative easing that was done earlier on, post actually 2007 and 8 through the global financial crisis. So they flooded the economy with cheap money then, and they continued to do it for 20 odd years. So that's got to be unwound. And the second point is that a lot of the inflation was supply chain disruption. Now, directly, if you lift the interest rates, you're not actually addressing supply chain disruption. What you're trying to do is to tailor effectively demand to meet supply, but that's a very indirect thing. And again, it impacts households, partially and complexly, particularly those on low incomes. So I think we've got ourselves into this situation where central banks made so many bad decisions on the way down, they're now making more bad decisions on the way up. And unfortunately, we, the people, are the cannon fodder.
Yes. And so so if it, you touched on a couple of things that you would do if you were like in charge, so to speak. But what's give us more. What would you do is, or what do you recommend as the remedy? Not to say that we will ever have the power to.
Well, the first thing, I think the Reserve Bank has to take accountability for house prices, like they've done in New Zealand. That would be a major one. Secondly, we've got to look at housing supply, particularly, I think, for those who are unable to get into the market. But thirdly, we need to actually get economists and the central bankers to understand how credit works. At the moment, they don't. They think it's a pass or it doesn't matter. Actually, the amount of credit in the system is huge. So we need to think about the way that the economy works and economists work, and many economists are partially to blame. So I think we need to re-educate economists too.
So yes, so part of the remedy is for economists to actually know economics.
And it would be nice, wouldn't it?
And for banking and financiers to actually know banking and finance. You've been a wonderful guest. We should have you on again. This is Martin North, and Martin North can be found at all one word, no lower, no underscores, no nothing. www.digitalfinanceanalytics.com. This is TNT. We're going to an ad break.
Matt Boyland here with a look at your TNT headlines. One third of Australia's population have had their personal data exposed in what is believed to be the country's largest ever cyber attack. A US aircraft carrier has arrived in South Korea for the first time in 4 years in a military show of force aimed at sending a warning to North Korea. And Russian and Western diplomats have clashed over alleged war crimes in Ukraine during a heated meeting of the United Nations Security Council.
There's something about living here. The skies that change right before your eyes. And people that look out for each other. A community that does its bit to plan and prepare to keep everyone safe. Because bushfire is just a part of life here. We've been through it before. And we'll get through it again. We live with bushfire, so we live bushfire ready.
For all the latest community events, rallies, marches, festivals, and fundraisers happening near you, visit the What's On Events calendar on the TNT Radio website at tntradio.live. Stay in touch on TNT Radio.
Yes, this is TNT and this is Robert Brennan. And now, as always, there are many significant economic, political developments that could affect us profoundly that happened both here but also abroad. We're very fortunate to be able to speak to people from around the globe, TNT being an international radio station, and who are willing to share their insights, you could say. Professor Chen Hong has devoted his life, his career, to a study of Australia and its literature, for example, the works of Patrick White. He's been a director of the Australian Studies Centre at the East China Normal University in Shanghai since 2001, where he is based, and he previously was a frequent and very welcome and honoured guest of Australia until, Professor Hong, can you tell us initially, just as by way of part of your introduction, what happened that had you prohibited from entering our shores back with when Home Affairs sent you the letter?
Yeah, today it still remains as an enigma. Mm-hmm. Because, as you said, actually, I've been devoting, you know, myself, committing my career, you know, to the study of Australia. I teach, you know, in my university, classes of Australian studies, literature, mm-hmm. Australian politics, China-Australia relations. And also, I have got a nationwide MOOCs course, you know, which actually attracts altogether annually about 5,000 students across the country, you know, to study a course about, you know, Australia. So it was all of a sudden when I received, you know, in 2020, you know, an email from the Home Affairs notifying me that my visa to Australia, a business visa to Australia, was cancelled on the ground that, you know, I was assessed by, you know, the security, intelligence, agencies in Australia as sort of like a risk to security, presumably, of course, security of Australia. So I was very much, dumbfounded, and felt that actually that was really indeed a kind of, a gross mistake, because that's definitely not reflecting the true sense, the truth of my relationship with Australia. So I sent Home Affairs a letter, to explain, my relationship with Australia, and also, ask if it is possible that they could contact me, and to find out, whether, there could be any misunderstanding. But until this day, this moment, I haven't heard from them at all, from Home Affairs or from any other Australian authorities, about, the issue of visa cancellation. So I hope actually, someone could really, answer, my queries and, let me to clarify, situations if they do have any, problems, about my relationship with Australia, they're very welcome to contact me.
Mm, yes. And I mean, imagine like when I hear what you have to say, there's the idea of jurisprudence that Australia inherited from Britain and which was, I think, probably came into its full maturity in the due process that United States citizens enjoy, where if an accusation is made against you, that you ought to have, you ought to be afforded the right to an outline of what that accusation actually is in the specific sense, not just that you're a risk to security, and to be able to face your accusers and defend yourself. And yet we're now 2 years down the track and it's still a mystery.
Yeah, it's a mystery. There's nothing at all, from the Australian authorities, as to my queries about the nature of those accusations. So it is still, I think, I hopefully, there's that was a kind of, misunderstanding, but I'm not sure so what's happening over there.
So given that you're, albeit viewing things from through a Chinese lens, you're a an expert in Australian studies and in China-Australian relations, and that's been your career, did you reappraise your views, or how do you now view Australia in light of that event?
Yeah, I think actually I have I started my, interest in Australia, academic interest in Australia in 1987. Mm-hmm. So over the years, over the decades, I've been, studying Australian literature, society, politics. I do have a very fond, impression, of Australia, and I like Australia, the Australian people, friends. Even when some friends do have some different opinions, political or cultural opinions, but that doesn't affect our relationship, our friendship. So I think that is actually the what is valuable, between friends, that is actually because of candidness, which actually can lead to something that is more constructive. Mm-hmm. So, but over the recent several years, I think actually in Australia, it's in particular, during the Turnbull-Morrison administration, there was a kind of like a ferocious campaign, following, the Washington's anti-China campaign to smear and scare, campaign, towards China, and that has caused a kind of like disastrous aftermath towards the bilateral relations. This year is the 50th anniversary of China-Australia relations. For 50 years, the two countries were being achieving a lot, the mutually beneficial relationship, which contributed towards the economic, social, political, cultural, prosperity in both countries. That is very, very good, very, very important. But, if in particular, for example, like last year when Peter Dutton, when Scott Morrison was talking about war with China, with some kind of, drums of war were, beating, for war with China. That was really something that is simply unthinkable, for us, and also, for many friends in Australia. So I think actually, hopefully, things will change. But still, I think there are still a kind of like a force latent, or even, a kind of force that is working to obstruct a more constructive relationship between China and Australia as a way to pledge, you know, allegiance to Washington, in particular those China hawks, trying to contain and also to crush China's development. So I think actually there are a lot of things for us to do to dispel misunderstanding and also to do a more proactive work towards the improvement of the bilateral relations.
Yes. And speaking of the US, at the top of the last hour, I was talking about a recent 60 Minutes interview with the president of the US, and he stated that that if China was to militarily act against Taiwan, that US would weigh in, would counterattack. No, that's not to suggest that China has designs to do anything militarily against Taiwan, but certainly that speaks of the US readiness to look at warfare rather than diplomacy.
I think this is not the first time Biden has made such remarks. And of course the White House, almost like rushed to make a sort of like clarification that, U.S.-China policy has not changed. But definitely, Biden has been making such so-called gaffes, but one mistake could be an accident. But if similar mistakes are being repeated again and again, the aim, I think, is to make such remarks as a kind of, routinized or normal way to, reflect the U.S. policy towards Taiwan. So I think actually there are a lot of, domestic political factors. Biden's statements, I think, is a choice out of, political convenience, with the midterm, elections approaching, and also Biden's, approving, approval rates has been declining, So I think actually for Biden, he tries to, uphold a kind of hardline stance on China, and so as to ease a kind of like pressure from his opponents within the Democrats and also from the Republicans. So a kind of playing the China card or anti-China card actually is sort of like a way to, enlist the support, because actually sort of like in the recent years, sort of like, if you're anti-China, if you're sort of like, you've been acting as, being tough and rough towards China, is almost like a form of the so-called political correctness. So that is actually, I think, like a way, I think also not only about Biden, but also his administration is trying to make use of his appearance of senility, trying to make him to be making such kind of, sort of like a dropping a line, like a hinting of a US act. But I don't think actually really, Biden, or the US, authorities could really, decide upon a kind of like more military, clarified, intention to act against China. I think actually for U.S., that would really, bring a lot of aftermath, which I don't think actually the United States is really prepared to do that. Yeah.
Well, that's right, because like at the top of the last hour, I was talking about how at the end of the Carter administration, they were recognizing that the capital of China to be in Beijing, to one China to include Taiwan, and the rhetoric then was to make friends with China so as to battle the USSR. This was the time of the Cold War, but now everything's changed. Now the Cold War is over, the USSR is no more. Now there's the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and now there's a relationship, or correct me if I'm wrong, between Russia and China. And so things are quite different. So how do you see that being played out in so much as what Russia is doing in Ukraine affects China-Australia-US relations on one hand, and on the other, it's are we going to go into a multipolar world of BRIC versus US or what?
I think actually the United States is recognizing a kind of like opportunity, to use the Russia-Ukraine conflict, to on one hand to bring down Russia, and also try to copy this kind of tactic, to the cross Taiwan Straits situation, you know, to contain the Chinese mainland. You know, I think actually the United States seems to have tasted a kind of like a flute, you know, the sweetness of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, you know. And, you know, because this is all kind of like a proxy war, you know, with us committing, you know, the U.S. troops, you know, the United States is using its military and financial support, you know, to Ukraine, not only to boost its arms trade, but also to gain the support of a number of other countries to sanction Russia, trying to bring down Russia, you know. But the Taiwan question is completely different in nature from the Ukraine crisis, because Ukraine is a sovereign country, but Taiwan is part of China. So it is essentially, I think, actually China kind of, you know, a kind of game, you know, played by the United States, trying to make use of the Taiwan question, trying to contain and also contain the development of China. So I think actually, you know, as we were discussing, you know, the proxy war, you know, proxy war is can best suit its interest, because actually it can turn Taiwan into a kind of a kind of force which could, you know, increase, you know, China, the Chinese mainland's cost to reunify with the Taiwan Islands. That is a kind of way, you know, to both to, you know, to embarrass China, trying to contain China's development, and also to create more obstacles towards the unification of China. That could actually be a kind of like strategy, I think, on the part of the Washington's, you know, China hawks.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. We're going to go to a quick ad break, and then we'll talk more after that. This is TNT.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
Well, what do you know? Finally, a so-called progressive who worked up the nerve to fire back, verbally, of course, at a member of the famed squad. He's 75-year-old Gerald Nadler, who's been representing New York in the Congress forever, and who recently beat another longtime Democrat House member, Carolyn Maloney, as two districts merged into one. This after Maloney called Nadler senile. He fired back after Michigan Democrat Rashida Tlaib announced, "I want you all to know that among progressives, it's become clear you cannot claim to hold progressive values yet back Israel's apartheid government." She said this during an online seminar. Nadler followed that with a tweet saying, "I fundamentally reject the notion that one cannot support Israel's right to exist as a Jewish and democratic state and be a progressive." Now, it may not seem like much, but it stands out in a Democrat Party that's been willing to stand by and let Israel be bashed and bashed over and over again, apparently out of fear of incurring the wrath of the squad members. Well, let's see how many more are willing to follow Nadler's brave lead. My prediction? Nobody. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg on TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Julian Assange dared to expose the truth. He dared to expose war crimes and corporate corruption. And he's now a political prisoner, while the mainstream media censors and distorts the true story. In May 2019, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture, Nils Melzer, published a scathing condemnation of the injustice inflicted on Julian Assange. Melzer said, quote, "In 20 years of work with victims of war, violence, and political persecution, I have never seen a group of democratic states ganging up to deliberately isolate, demonize, and abuse a single individual for such a long time, and with so little regard for human dignity and the rule of law," unquote. And Melzer said, "This can only be described as psychological torture." Years later, Assange still sits in jail with barely a whimper of protest from the so-called free media.
Elon Musk wants Jack Dorsey to turn over Twitter info on spam or spam bot accounts. Yet the Australian government and Digi, which includes Twitter, wants to address fake bots and fake accounts. The disinformation and misinformation is from the government and big tech. Disagree with what government is saying and you'll be shut down and could face severe penalties. To find out more, go to digi.org.au. Lighting the fuse for freedom. This is TNT Radio.
Yes, this is TNT and this is Robert Brennan, my very special guest, academic professor Chen Hong, who is an Australian studies expert, an Australian literature expert at East China Normal University in Shanghai. We were talking before the break about sort of Ukraine and Taiwan and China-US relations. Now, one way of framing things was that the West provoked Ukraine into the sort of actions it took, which in turn provoked the Russia to invade it. Do you see the US or the West in general doing similar things with Taiwan? Has Taiwan been saying provocative things against the Chinese mainland? And how is that being interpreted?
Yeah, I think there has been a persistence, push, from the West, trying to, bring down, Russia, trying to bring down China. And one of the tactics is actually, as you said, is to provoke, sort of like to provoke tensions. We see, in the previous decades, the color revolution, intentionally trying to stir up, tensions, both at the border and also within, some countries, so as to change the political inclination of those countries. So for the Ukraine and Russia scenario, I think definitely, we have been recognizing a kind of like similar pattern in which, the West has been stirring up tensions between the two countries. And also, this kind of expansion of NATO has been putting, Russia on a kind of like a tightrope, trying to, to be always, constantly vigilant or possible, just definitely, almost like, the danger on the doorstep. Just imagining, those, missile crisis in Cuba could actually stir up such kind of tension, in the United States. And now, just suppose, at the time when, Ukraine, is being, enlisted into this kind of, anti-Russia camp, Russia definitely felt threatened. But of course, Russia, Ukraine is a sovereign country, and China always opposes this kind of independence and sovereignty of nations, non-interference policies, and also China hopes actually both countries could exert, restraints and resort to diplomatic means to resolve, tensions rather than, to let the conflict to exacerbate. That is one thing. But on the other hand, we see a similar tactic, being, used by the West, by the US-led West, for example, trying to stir up tensions in Xinjiang along the Chinese borders with India, in Hong Kong, and also on the island of Taiwan. Those are all, the domestic issues within China, but actually, the United States has simply been trying to make it to appear like it is a kind of like international issue and trying to create tensions and trying to stir up a kind of like a China threat theory. And on the other hand, of course, is also this kind of disinformation campaign is to, trying to obfuscate the real nature of the Taiwan question, because Taiwan is part of China, but definitely, the United States has been trying to create this kind of impression that, simply, there was this kind of, mythology about the Chinese invasion of Taiwan, but this is definitely not true, because United States can't invade Hawaii, Australia can't invade Tasmania. So for, the Taiwan issue is definitely a domestic issue. Definitely, this is not a kind of like international or, so basically between, mainland China and also Taiwan Islands, that's definitely a different scenario, different nature from that between Russia and Ukraine.
And speaking of islands, although not Taiwanese islands, China is quite active in the Pacific and South Pacific, and recently there was some, I believe, some sort of development in the Solomon Islands, and so many of the Western Australia, let's say the Australian political right and the US political right, will be concerned that what might appear as just business relations and development in the Pacific will be a springboard towards something more aggressive in future. Aviation tarmacs that can be used for military aircraft, ports that can be used for military sea craft, that sort of thing. So what's your take on that?
Well, first, of course, we can never make any, political, jump to conclusions based upon hypothesis. And on the other hand, of course, the China's cooperation between, with, South Pacific Island countries are definitely based on economic cooperation. not of a military or, you know, security issue. For example, take the Solomon Islands as an example. You know, there has been a kind of like a mythology about sort of like a China Solomon Islands security agreement. But that security is about, you know, security of the society. That is actually, that means anti-rights, you know, that so in other words, cooperation, so so-called security cooperation is between the police forces, between Chinese police forces and also the local, you know, Solomon Islands police force. Because as we know, last year there was a riot, anti-Chinese riot in the Solomon Islands. So the Solomon Islands, you know, authorities, you know, requested the Chinese police authorities to provide aid, to provide training for local police forces. So that actually is to ensure a kind of like social order and also the business environment. So because actually China does have a business interest in the Solomon Islands, you know, where always trade with the investments. So if actually, of course, the social order is constantly being disrupted, that is definitely not conducive to the stability and also the prosperity of the local environment. So police, you know, cooperation is being described as security, and security, of course, can also, you know, lead to, you know, a broader, you know, understanding about a kind of like military or defense cooperation. I think this is once again kind of like disinformation or kind of like a deliberate, obfuscation of those notions, trying to make those kind of very, you know, peace loving, you know, peace in nature cooperation to become something that is military in nature, but that is definitely not reflecting the truth of the cooperation between China and the Solomon Islands.
Do you think it's possible where minor nations, and in a sense I include Australia here, because although we're geographically vast, our population is small and the like, do you think that there's a sense in which the minor nations will be forced into a choice of who are their economic and cultural friends, be it whether it's the US or China in the coming decades? Or do you think it's possible for minor nations like South Pacific nations to be truly friends with both the US and China? Is it possible, or is realistic, the realpolitik is they're going to have to take a side?
Yeah, because actually, if we're talking about, you know, South Pacific island countries, those countries, many of them adopt a policy of friends with all and enemy with none, foreign policy. That is actually, I think, a very, you know, rational choice of policies, because for those countries, they don't want to become a kind of like an instrument or tool of powers such as the United States to be used, to be weaponized against China. So I think actually for those countries, you know, they want to maintain a kind of like, positive and constructive relationship with China, and while also, you know, maintaining good relationship with other countries. I think China also, you know, make, you know, its policies very clear that actually China, you know, does not exclude, you know, any third party, you know, cooperation, for example, in the Solomon Islands, you know, while, you know, China has got this kind of a very, you know, active and successful cooperation, you know, with the local countries. Actually, of course, Australia, the United States, China doesn't really, you know, oppose to their involvement, or even, you know, China has expressed that China can work with Australia, with the United States, with New Zealand, you know, to, you know, in projects, in ventures in those countries. So I think this is a kind of like, we're all talking about a win-win, but definitely this is a kind of like all-win situation. But definitely, I don't think actually the United States is recognizing a situation like this. They try to become something that is unipolar, you know, they are kind of like monopolizing its relationship, trying to make the South Pacific areas like a closed, you know, exclusive, ostracized, you know, area. But that's definitely against the trade trend of globalization and free trade.
Okay. And another question, I mean, Trudeau has given the truckers grief and imprisoned a couple and closed down civil liberties in Canada. And similar has happened with anti-lockdown protesters in Australia. Is there any currency at all to, you know, the stories that we get of Falun Gong and Uyghurs being sent off to concentration camps? What's your take on that?
I don't see that. I think actually the disinformation campaign, launched in the West has been really very ferocious. For example, like his depiction of the situation in Xinjiang is definitely against the truth. I've been to Xinjiang. I visit Xinjiang myself as a tourist, and we have got teachers and professors to be supporting those universities in Xinjiang. So what they have been bringing back, what I have witnessed over there, are actually definitely against what the West has been depicting about a kind of like the so-called concentration camp. That's definitely not true, And we know the vocational training centers, which actually try to, provide vocational training, trying to de-radicalize some kind of people if they fall into, the victim of some kind of, terrorist training from some countries. So I think actually those has proved to bring, a kind of like a prosperity and success in the local economy and also social development.
Okay.
Because as you can see, the population in Xinjiang has developed, has risen.
Professor Hong, we're going to have to, I'm going to have to break you off. We're going to have to have you back on. We're a wealth of perspectives here, and you've been a wonderful guest. This is TNT.